The ARA acknowledges the traditional owners of the land where we have recorded this podcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present, and recognise Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders as Australia's first traders, who utilise a sophisticated network of trading paths that have facilitated the exchange of goods, knowledge, and culture for millennia.
Hi, I'm Paul Zara, CEO of the Australian Retailers Association, and welcome to Season 6 of the Retail Therapy Podcast, proudly brought to you by American Express. In today's retail landscape, it's vital to understand the nuance and intricacies of diversity, equality, and inclusion. It isn't just a buzzword, but a powerful force driving innovation and change across the sector. In each episode this season, we'll be focusing on the specific branch of the D&I tree, speaking to pioneers and leaders in their respective fields. Joining me for some retail therapy focusing on diversity, equality and inclusion is Anyer Yule, an inspiring entrepreneur with an appetite for social change. Anyer is the founder of Miss Sahara, an initiative on behalf of Lead Beyond Education Charity, and founder and CEO of Anyer Model Management. Lead Beyond Education provides life-changing opportunities through education, human rights advocacy and leadership capacity development to culturally and racially marginalised women and girls from underrepresented groups in Australia and refugee camps. Anyer has been influential in her advocacy activities in creating a space where young people are able to use their voice to bring change. This year, she won the 2023 Australia for UNHCR SBS Les Murray Award for refugee recognition for her diverse achievements across sport, women's empowerment, and refugee advocacy. Anyer, welcome.
Thank you.
Anyer, let's set the scene for listeners. I understand you were a South Sudanese refugee at a young age. What was that experience like, and how has it shaped the person you've become today?
Oh, thank you very much, Paul, for having me, by the way. I think my journey as a former refugee growing up in a refugee camp has somehow been an exciting journey for me, to be honest. I get asked often about my experience and how I have perceived or seen it. But for me, I think the first 10 years were the most innocent, exciting, and a fulfilling in a sense that refugee camp was the only place that I ever knew. I never knew that there was another world that exists beyond those boundaries. And so whatever I had, the family that I've had, the friends that I grew up with, everything that I look forward within that community, it was the excitement that I so innocently adore when I was in the refugee camp, whether it's just going outside to play with my friends, playing in the dirt, or, you know, just wandering around the community. It was a blessing. Wow. It was a blessing for me. So I'm not the type of person to often sit back and say that I had a hard time. Yes, now that when I look back as I grow and I work in this space, I can see some of the difficulties that refugees face within those settings. But when you are raised within that environment, you don't get excited to see the wall because you don't know if the world exists or if there's anything else that exists beyond those boundaries. So for me, I always said I had a very fulfilling, that's how I can describe it. And I had a safe net within that space that I knew.
Most refugees wouldn't describe a refugee camp the way you just did to me just now.
Yeah.
So explain that to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes it's your own understanding and how you perceive things. And I think for me, as an early age as I can remember, I've always seen the world around me from a different perspective. Things that could potentially be hard to some people, I somehow always see them as from a brighter perspective. And I've noticed the lack of, you know, education, the lack of quality of life when I, as young as I was.
Yes.
But I think I was surrounded by love. I grew up in a community, in a collective society, where I had the support that I needed. you know, just like many of the refugees have lost someone during the war or whatever the path is. I lost my parent, but I've never felt like I lost parent because I had such a great support system. And every small little things that I ever needed, it was presented to me. So for me, I can only describe it as something that was positive. But of course, it could have been a different story yes. if I had felt those things as well. And I probably would have responded differently.
Now, you say support. Both parents have passed?
Yes, both of my parents have
passed. So you had brothers and sisters with you?
I have one older sister.
Okay. Yeah. Was she in the refugee camp with
you? She was older than me, and she moved to Australia with me as well.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So the support came from others within the camp?
Correct. The support came from others, you know, when my parents passed. I had a lovely aunt who took my sister and I in and she treated us like her own. And that support also came from extended family. And as a South Sudanese, we come from a very collective society. And so even if you find yourself where you probably lost both parents, the community is there to nurture you. And so I think one of my strengths that I always drew from that is that I grew up from an environment where I didn't have to feel like I didn't have anyone.
That's amazing. Now, do you think it gives you a unique perspective when it comes to diversity and inclusion, having been through an experience like that?
I don't think it does to the full capacity because I think lived experience itself is not enough to address the work that I do now.
Right.
To some element, I do believe that it's always good to have a lived experience perspective in everything that we do, including the diversity and inclusion space that I am here. I would have to experience it so then I can understand it. But you also need tangible degrees,
yes.
extreme of work and commitment to fully understand some of those elements that really, you know, create disadvantages within this space.
Yes.
And so for me, I don't think it's enough and my lived experience itself is not enough. And I think that's one of the reasons I have committed myself to do more and find ways to, you know, increase my skills and knowledge to even do better.
That's amazing. As someone who has experienced the refugee journey firsthand, what are some of the most critical needs and support systems that refugees require when settling into a new country?
Oh, Paul, there's so many. And if we had a whole day, we could talk about a lot of the need. But I would just start from, you know, simple things that I have always come across. And it is employment for many of refugees that come into this country. Yes, first is English. You arrive, you want to learn the language, and because learning the language would allow you to really integrate in a simplistic way as possible that you
yes.
can.
Yes.
So you can navigate the system and you can navigate yourself around. But second to that is employment. If I can speak from a young people perspective, those who might have enough energy to get into the workforce, those yes. who might have the responsibility to cater to their families and to find, you know, ways of creating economic benefit, they are eager to go to work. They want to work.
Yes.
And so that is one of the areas that is definitely significant and often most needed to support the refugees.
Mm-hmm.
And so that as well, but also that social connection to the new country that they are going to,
mm-hmm.
you know, just people being welcoming and acknowledging that a lot of the refugees have come from a conflict background that they didn't choose to escape their country and come here. They are forced to leave their country. And so I think often that social connection is needed, but it's not there.
I've heard once before, if you give a refugee a job, you give them a life. Is that true?
You know, I think that's beyond the stretch because it sounds like you're begging usually when I
yes.
hear words like that. But in general, you give anyone a job, you give them a new perspective in life.
Yes.
We live in a world that what could you do without a job? You got to pay your bills.
Yes.
And so for many of refugees that come here, you give them the opportunity and they will contribute back to the society.
Yes.
And that's how we should be able to see it. So that will be my take on that.
Okay. You raise a good point. So whilst we're on misconceptions or stereotypes about refugees, what else have you encountered in your advocacy work and how can we dispel them?
Yeah, I mean, if we stay on this topic, particularly on the employment, I mean, one of the misconceptions that I often hear is that, oh, refugees don't need work. They get money from Centrelink. They're on the dole. They don't want to do anything. You get really misconceptions, discriminatory words that really put people as others.
Yes.
Which is really lacking awareness and knowledge. And it's not good for many refugees who come with significant knowledges. And a lot of the refugees who come here have degrees. And imagine that often even the skill set that come with them are not even recognized here. No. And then they have to start over again. Already they are doing significant work to integrate into this society and contribute economically. And so those misconceptions that refugees don't want to work or they are getting things for free from government, that is not true. I remember one, you know, I was asked, said, well, you know, when refugees come here, they just get handed over with money by the government and they don't even have to work for like 1 year or so. Absolutely nonsense. Yes. I remember from my own experience, my family that came with me, they had to go to work within 3 months or 4 months.
Yes.
And that is not enough time to even learn the language, to learn the culture, and to do anything. So you are not even given enough time to understand how the new world works or the new culture. You're just chalking to the deep end.
Is learning the language the biggest obstacle, do you think, for a refugee?
It is very, particularly for those who come at an older age.
Yes.
You know, for people like myself who probably arrived in this country when we were 10 years old,
yes.
It's easier because if you go to school here, automatically you are finding yourself in a space where you're speaking English often.
And you're in a learning
environment. And you're learning environment as well, where if you're coming as a teenager and you've already going to interact with a few challenges from intergenerational conflicts that you're going to face, integrating issues, you're going to find it hard to really navigate and learning the language. And so the extreme of learning it from the teenager is quite hard. And then compare that to the older generation who come here as well. If they are not in the space where they can learn, they are not going to learn. And often because the social connection, it's a disadvantage when they arrive here. They might just end up grouping with their own community members because they find comfort. And that also disadvantages them from learning because they're with their community again, but also because the doors haven't been open from the wider Australian community and they haven't been given the space to learn. And so you find that they really find themselves in a space where there's no winning for them.
Right.
And that adds a lot of pressure to the families and the dynamic of the communities that come as refugees here.
Yeah. Now, you've done lots of advocacy work in the field of diversity and refugee rights. What are your longer-term goals or aspirations for your work?
For me, I really think there is a fight on work in terms of my advocacy, and I see advocacy as an ongoing journey. There's no end to it. As long as there is a fight when it comes to structure, systematic issues that put people at disadvantage, I don't think I'm going to stop. So in terms of the long term, I'm going to still be here talking about this issue. The day that we stop talking about it will be the day that we have solved the world problem.
Yes.
So for me, there is no ending. I think I'm here to do my part and to make sure that we are contributing to the awareness and shining light on the issues that really matter the most, because that's the only way that we could do it.
Fair enough. I think you raised some really good points there. Now, you know the retail industry is the biggest private sector employer in the country. What role do you think the retail industry have in driving inclusivity around refugees?
Look, I actually started within retail for my first job, and retail is one of those industries that it's so big, and in terms of employment, have the capability to get to open the diverse portfolio.
Yes.
I really think that we really need to be active within the emerging communities that are coming, and we need to find ways to get into those communities, whether we go through school program,
Yes.
To market the jobs that are available within retail. So I think the biggest thing that is missing is that retail have not marketed themselves well to every individual, including the emerging refugees communities, because the way that the community see it, they see retail as not a long-term goal. Because to them, they think that, oh, you just do it when you go to school. But they haven't thought about, I could become a manager.
Yes.
I could become a national director for a particular area.
Yes. Well, welcome to my world, because we have this conversation all the time. People don't see retail as a career. And fortunately, we're trying to change that. In fact, I started my first job as a casual at the local Target store.
Yeah.
Then went on to become a CEO. So it's very doable. And my story is not unique. There's many CEOs have done the same thing. So you mentioned you worked in a retail store. Do you want to disclose where that was?
Yes. My first job was at David Jones Country Road.
No.
Yes. I went through it all. I went to Country Road at David Jones in Parramatta.
Yeah.
Then I went to Witchery in Bondi. Then I went to Maya. Then I went back to Country Road. So I went through all the big brands.
Okay. So you worked in department stores like me.
As well, I did.
There you go.
And then I tell, even before I even went to those, I went to fast food, like McDonald's was my first job actually before that.
That's good.
And I remember someone said, but it's not, you can't sustain a career. I said, absolutely not. I said, who do you think are running these big department stores?
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, and so I think the narrative need to change from the industry perspective.
Yeah.
They need to appeal to young people at an early age.
Yes.
And picture them, paint them a picture where they could see themselves.
Yes.
So I definitely think they have a role there, in particular targeting new emerging young people, because it is an opportunity that is out there, and you and I know both.
Absolutely. You're right. You raise some good points. Now, listen, I was interesting because I was in the US recently. Yeah. And the US department stores and retailers are generally much better at recruiting refugees, and they've actually made it a specific strategy, as some retailers have around gender, but specifically to refugees. So I do think hopefully this podcast will kick that thinking off. And yeah, that's what we're aiming to do, because there's currently, at the time of recording this podcast, over nearly 40,000 vacancies in the industry, over 38,000. So there's a lot of vacancies. So we need new strategies, and this is something that retailers should be thinking about.
Absolutely, I think so.
Yeah. So look, the other area I wanted to discuss with you was really around supply chains and retail supply chains. They can be complex. And how do you think retailers can ensure that their sourcing practices are ethical and support vulnerable communities, including refugees?
Yeah. Oh, big word there. The supply chain is very difficult to understand. As you said, even me, sometimes I question. But look, it started by understanding the community that you are catering to.
Yes.
You know, we always get brand talking about ethical practices, where in practice how they look like, it's about making sure we're getting into the community to first understand where they're coming from, what are some of the issues do they face, how do they practice, how do they like to receive information, how do they like to give the information out. That's one way of doing it. I'll give you an example. I remember when I was working for one of the retails, and they wanted to cater to the Muslim communities when I was modeling at the time. And they wanted to do a photo shoot with hijab, and they didn't know how to do about it. And they were asking the wrong question, asking people who were not Islamic background themselves and didn't wear hijab. And part of that was go to the community and ask, how do they present themselves? How do they want to present within the consumer space when we're talking about all these kind of things? So I always said, always know the communities that you are catering to, that you're serving to, that you want to market for.
Yes.
Because I think market is a significant thing when it comes to products and when it comes to services that we do here.
Yeah. Well, important point. I think for those retailers listening, if they want to learn more about how to actually tap into those diverse communities, there's many people out there that can help and support and consult and advise. And if you get caught, certainly let us know at the ARA and we can connect you appropriately.
What we do, and I always said, I think it comes to either industries are being lazy and they don't want to do the job when we come. We don't know how to do it. We don't know how to get there. you do. And I always say this to the fashion industry when they say, we can't find diverse faces. And I said, well, what am I doing here? I'm at the heart of the community. And yes. So, you know, there's always way when there's will.
Fair enough, Chan. Look, I think absolutely where there's a will, there's a way, and that comes down to it. And I think, you know, when you think about the retail community and given you've worked in the industry for a part of your career, how do you think we could better communicate our commitment to diversity and social causes without appearing opportunistic or insincere?
Yeah, look, it's really quite simple. People need to see themselves yes. in those spaces. And I always said, if, for example, we've been talking about the refugee communities that are looking for opportunities, if a lot of refugees don't see representation, whether we're talking about big department store, whether we're talking about beauties or, you know, hospitality, if they don't see enough engagement within the leadership, within yes. the people who are making decisions, they will feel like if they participate within those companies, they will not be understood. The issues that impact them
yes.
will not be understood. And so what we need to do is to make sure that we're focusing on where the decision-making is coming, making sure that we are as diverse in terms of representation. And I think it's really important that we remove ourselves when we think about now the concept of diversity and inclusion. We think that it's taking away the talent and we want to just pick so because we want to represent because that's what the policies say, that's yes, what the yes. government is saying. Yes. And when we start to think like that, that's when we start to really lose ourselves and we're not working toward addressing all the systematic issues that diverse communities might go through.
Yeah.
And I think one is learning, making sure that you truly teach yourself and learn what it means to be inclusive. If you put that as part of practice, it's not something that you're just going to mention just because you want to jump the bandwagon. It's really important. The second one is go out to communities, organizations, go out to different industries that might have more diversity yes. and inclusion in practice, not in policies. Find out which companies and organizations actually got it good. I mean, they're not going to have it 110%. But compare where are you going wrong? What are you not doing right? And compare yourself to those organizations and pick it up. You don't have to start it. You know, practices have been happening already. And so I think that's part as well. And then also leaders, those who are in a position of leadership with privilege, because often you can be in a position of leadership, but you don't have the privilege to say or to guide the practices the way that you want.
Yes.
And so you have to align yourself and you have to get people who are willing to do something about it. The conversation needs to shift.
Yes.
And I'm really glad I came to your show today because I always said we're coming to this stage now where everyone is starting to question the benefit of diversity and inclusion. Why do we talk about it? It doesn't do anything. It's taking away the talent. It's taking away this. And I just want to say that it doesn't take away a talent. If you focus on the person and say, you know what, you have a talent and I want you, not because of your skin color, not because of your religion, not because of anything, not just so I can tick the box, but I want to take you because you have a talent. But being aware that it is still important to have that inclusivity representation within yes. your industry. So I definitely think it's a reflective process for anyone who wants to do good and create a society where everyone is represented.
And there's economic benefit to it too.
Correct.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You raise some really good points. I'm going to ask you this question. If you could leave our listeners with one message or call to action regarding refugees and diversity, what would it be?
If I were to leave our message with one, I will say no one should be allowed to beg for a representation in our society. No one should be begging. And I think we should all just view this society as we want to contribute to an economic growth in Australia. And that is what I would leave to our listeners.
And what a beautiful message. And yeah, appreciate you joining us as a Retail Therapy today. Thank you for sharing your remarkable journey and all the best in the future.
Thank you.
I would now like to welcome Mitchell Kurius, Chief Financial Officer at Barbecues Galore, to the Amex Lounge. Barbecues Galore has been supplying Australians with high-quality barbecues and expert advice since 1977. With more than 90 stores throughout the country, Barbecues Galore leads the barbecue retailing market and is a specialist in outdoor furniture and heating. Barbecues Galore has been an American Express merchant for more than two decades. Mitch, welcome.
Hi, Paul. Great to be here with you.
Barbecues Galore is an iconic Australian brand that started as a small business more than 45 years ago. Mitch, can you describe the recent journey of the brand, its challenges, and the transformation over the past 5 years?
The recent journey of Barbecues Galore over the last 5 years has really been to stay true to the heritage of the brand whilst developing our platforms around brand, team, and technology to support the changing dynamics of the consumer through this period. We've seen through the last 5 years some significant macro disruptions from bushfires of 2019 to COVID to supply disruptions. And through that period, the organisation has really galvanised and in really strong position looking forward.
Now, Mitch, it's a tricky time for retailers at the moment as cost of living pressures start to take their toll. How is Barbecues Galore adapting to this and what does the future hold?
A core focus for the organisation is to really focus on demonstrating value through the assortment at every touch point of the assortment. And the team have done a tremendous job through the little while to ensure that we have new, innovative and sometimes exclusive product to really surprise and delight our customers. We also recognise that cost of living pressures are not just on the shoulders of customers but also on our team, and we've done a really put in a lot of work in around ensuring that Barbecues Galore is an employer of choice and supporting our team with those cost of living pressures.
Now, Barbecues Galore purpose is bringing people together around the flame, those great connections formed around food and fire. Now, how do you go about developing those connections for your customers and your colleagues, and why is this important?
Humans have been sharing treasured moments around a flame for millennia, Paul. And that gives us some really rich material to work with, tooling the team up with their career pathways and help them with that whole sales process helps us to deliver on the purpose to customers as well.
Mitch, thank you for joining us today in the Amex Lounge. All the best for the future.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks for joining us in the Amex Lounge for some retail therapy. Make sure you subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify. We can be found wherever you listen to your favourite podcasts. For more information about the work we do at the Australian Retailers Association, head to our website, retail.org.au. Follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, wherever you love to connect. All the links can be found in the show notes.